Hi everyone, welcome to The Social Block, the podcast that explores the intersection between blockchain technology and society. It's a very special time in the blockchain space. As many of you know, it's almost time for the Bitcoin halving, or depending on when you're listening to this episode, it may already have happened. But I know a lot of people are wondering, what is the Bitcoin halving? What's going to happen after it? How is it going to affect prices and everything in the space? And the good news is, I've taken it upon myself to find a guest that can explain the halving and talk about it, and also explore it from a cultural perspective, as in what it means for our community in the blockchain space and more at large. And the episode also features a few of my own very dystopian, futuristic ideas of what the Bitcoin halving is going to be in the future. So without further ado, here to explain the Bitcoin halving for us is Joe Nakamoto. How are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah. I've had a very busy few days at this Bedford conference and the football match as well. And then I saw my brother last night. And then, yeah, this morning I'm trying to work out where to work when on the run. Not on the run, on the move.
Oh my God. What's the conference? What's the event?
It was called Cheat Code. And it was all about how people can adopt Bitcoin in their businesses and in their, you know, respective domains around the world. The idea being that if you adopt Bitcoin, it helps you to do other stuff in life. And so, yeah, it was put on by Peter McCormack, who you might know, the guy that does what Bitcoin did.
Yeah.
And it was in Bedford, which is this town in London. And yeah.
I know, I was just like, why out of all of those places, why Bedford? But yeah, interesting. Anyway. It's a really random, yeah, especially like sense, right? Coming right after PBWS and then Bedford.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
but that's no, really exactly. Awesome.
Yeah. How about yourself?
I'm good.
How are you doing? And are things busy in Bulgaria right now?
I mean,
the bull run is back.
I think they're busy globally for us because I tend to work more on like outside of Bulgaria, like media and stuff. So yeah, they are quite busy. Like I'm quite busy with like AMAs, the podcast. Like we've got so many episodes we want to make around the halving. And like there's a lot of guests who are just kind of like, I want to talk about this and the halving. I want to talk about this and the halving. So I was just like, we just need like a base level halving episode first. So that's been mostly me. Yeah. Quite busy as well. It definitely like the bull run just completely puts your work into a different perspective. Like it just like you think everything is like really intense and then the bull run comes and you're just like like dead. Oh my God. So much work.
Yeah, I'm not ready for it. I'm not ready for it either.
You never are. Yeah, I don't think so. So I like to start off a little bit by asking our guests to tell our listeners a little bit more about themselves and what they do, just to give them an idea of who they're listening to.
Okay. Are we rolling right now, by the way?
Oh, yeah, yeah, we've been rolling. If you want me to cut something out, I can cut it out. Like, you can just let me know.
Don't worry, I don't mind at all. There are plenty of embarrassing videos of me on the internet, so this is not a problem at all. So who am I? I'm Joe Nakamoto. That's obviously not my real name. Satoshi Nakamoto is no relation to me. I feel it's, you know, quite basic putting that out there, but some people do ask sometimes.
Just letting you guys
and
know.
I'm a... Yeah, exactly. Just full disclosure, not Satoshi or related. And I'm a Bitcoin advocacy journalist, which means that I, of course, advocate for Bitcoin with the journalism that I do. And I fell into this work having worked at Cointelegraph, which, of course, you know, and a friend.
I do. Nexo. You know, and one thing that, like, I think I've actually emailed you years ago.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Like, when was this?
Like a while ago, like you were working at Cointelegraph, and because like you go by your, I think that at the time you were going by like your regular name, and
actual
I only
name, like normal people do.
Yeah, like I only realized this right. Like a little bit like a week or so ago when like my manager put us in touch, and I was just kind of like I googled you, and I was like, oh, I think I've written this person emails. Like I think I've pitched you press releases.
Interesting. Let's find an email.
Oh, no.
I still have access to the Cointelegraph accounts because I'm still waiting on some content from them because I do video documentaries, and one of the video documentaries that I did with them is still outstanding. So yeah, I could go through and find them. But my journalism and the content I created through Cointelegraph was really, really rarely through PR agencies and companies. It was always about human interest stories, underdog stories, and people using Bitcoin in really interesting and creative ways. So yeah, if I didn't reply, I'm really sorry. But here I am now, you know, 2.5 years later.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for joining us. So since we're going to talk about the Bitcoin halving, why don't we start off by you telling our listeners what the halving actually is? And then we're going to go into what I'd love to do is like my backwards logic of wrong answers only. What is the Bitcoin halving? But let's start with the right one.
Okay. So the right one is, there's different ways you can explain this. And we'll go with, you know, the explain like I'm 8 years old analogy first, which is, you know, in the Bitcoin protocol, there are 21 million Bitcoin. And in 2009, 15 years ago now, there were 50 Bitcoin created every 10 minutes. So in order to get from 50 Bitcoin in the first 10 minutes of Bitcoin's ever existence to 21 million, there has to be an issuance or, you know, some Bitcoin created every so often. And the way in which the protocol was planned out was that every 10 minutes, there'd be 50 Bitcoin. But then every 4 years or every roughly, I can't remember if it's 10,080. I can't remember the exact number, but basically every 4 years, that issuance rate is halved. So in the first issuance rate went from 50 to 25, the second from 25 to 12.5, the third from 12.5 to 6.25. That's where we are now, by the way. And in a few days' time, it goes from that 6.25 to 3.125. And it's called the halving because literally the Bitcoin issuance rate is halved. And all you need to know about it really is that it helps keep Bitcoin on track to never exceed 21 million Bitcoin. So it keeps Bitcoin as this scarce, hard asset. And that's part of the reason that people think it's desirable. But if you're a Bitcoin miner, then of course you've been paid 6.25 Bitcoin every 10 minutes up until, you know, this Saturday, when you'll be paid 3.125 Bitcoin. So you need to work out how to stay profitable and how to still make money with the Bitcoin protocol, knowing that this issuance rate is going to be halved. I think that was like explained like I'm 8 or 9 years old. What do you think? I can go more technical, but I think
that's better, actually. Yeah, I think most of our listeners aren't, you know, hardcore blockchain developers. So getting more technical, I find, actually just makes it more complicated. The only thing I wanted to kind of pick out was, like, you mentioned the regularity of the halving, like basically every 4 years, but the dependency is basically at a certain block height, if I'm not mistaken. Am I right there?
That's right. So that's the number that I can't remember, and I've just opened up ChatGPT to ask them which number it is. I know that the issuance rate is every 2,080 blocks. So that's the rate at which the difficulty adjustment increases or decreases, and that's also part of the halving because that's what keeps this halving on this near-perfect timeline in which you can basically set your watch to it 4 years later. It's so cool, and that's why people have planned halving parties and halving events over from the 1st of April until the 30th of April, because everyone knew that this halving event would fall between this range based on how hard the miners hash. And hashing is just literally putting out a really long number that they think will be the correct one that will be the, you know, the one that fits in the next block and will be confirmed by all the nodes around the network. Again, yeah. It's 8:30 for me in the morning, so I'm sorry if I'm not making a huge amount of sense.
Yeah, you're good, you're good.
But yeah, this is where we're at.
Yeah, I remember with the last halving, there was a lot of talk about the hash rate and basically, which is related to the mining difficulty. And I remember people being concerned that like the mining difficulty would become too much. So a lot of miners would not have like essentially, I think, the computing power to keep mining profitably. So there was a lot of talk around that. So it is also, it's all interconnected, you know, the miners, when the halving happens, the rewards they really receive, and then how many miners they are also, I guess, affects hash rate and how difficult mining is going to be. Am I on the right track? Yeah. Did I get that? Yeah, I think like
that's,
I learned...
That's bang on.
Hmm? Yeah, so...
No, I'm saying that's bang on in that... You know, the other thing that people sort of overlook is that while mining is always about profitability, the only route to profitability is not just through inputs in and then, like, you know, the maximum output out. It's also maximum output out as well as other things that come with mining. For example, heat. So like a lot of miners might start turning on their miners when they know that they need to heat something with the electricity. Like me at home, I mine Bitcoin to keep my flat warm. So I don't care about profitability there. I care about heat. Likewise, if you're looking to stabilize a grid's demands, then you might start turning your miners on more when you know that there is no demand from the power grid on your miners. And so you know that energy is cheaper and you could turn it on and help to balance that grid load. There are different ways of looking at it. And it's maybe 10 years ago, it was literally inputs in, outputs out, make sure the whole system is profitable. Now there's different ways of addressing that to make it so that you can still mine Bitcoin and not necessarily be profitable. I'm doing that between quotation marks, mm-hmm. by the way. But you're doing it because you've got an added benefit. Some people might just mine because they think it's fun. You know, there's still that hobbyist element as well. There are people that will be literally solo mining. So like one person at home trying to mine Bitcoin, not in a pool either. So they're literally trying to get the correct hash to get it onto the next block. And they are still, you know, at it trying to mine. So it's a really interesting space now, the mining sector in 2024. And it's only going to get more interesting, what with the halving kicking
in. Yeah, it sounds like...
I just wanted to add that. Sorry.
It's incredibly complicated, actually, like the whole mining ecosystem. And I don't think a lot of people who aren't necessarily in it really understand it very well. Because there's so many people who operate in blockchain, but they're not necessarily super Bitcoin focused or like coin focused. A lot of them are looking at like tokens and stuff. So I think that's very interesting and like under talked about, if I can use that like Frankenstein of a word. So wrong answers only. What is the Bitcoin halving? Because I feel like I hear so many really bad ones. Like obviously the first big one is circulating supply is going to be halved. Like that's the big no-no. Do you hear that often?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the one that came out on French news at 7 o'clock in the evening, maybe 3 weeks ago, like an established journalist. I mean, I'm an established journalist. You just can't trust journalists generally. She went on the news and said, the thing with the halving is that the price is just going to cut in half. So if you want to participate in this market, that's on you. And it's like, wow. And this circulated around French Bitcoin Twitter for a while. So that's one, that the price will just halve because it's called le halving. Or, you know, le avenir, some people call. Well, if I put my thumb up, it gives a thumbs up.
Yeah, it's the Zoom thing. It also does like a heart, I think, but like, no, not working.
Yeah. Oh, heartbreak. Anyway, there you go. That's the Bitcoin halving. The Bitcoin halving heartbreak. That's
There it is. Oh my God. For the listeners who are listening to this on Spotify or somewhere where you don't have video, basically Joe was using the Zoom function that gives like hearts if you do heart hands, and then he put his hands apart and the hearts came out as right as he said Bitcoin halving.
There you go. So that's common misconception number two. And then number three, you mentioned that, Magdalena, which is that the circulation, of course, halves. That's not right. It's closer, though, which is good. And the final one is that I did this in a video recently about a circular economy in South Africa for my YouTube channel.
Yeah, I actually watched that. You sent it to me.
Oh, nice.
It was really good. I used to live in South Africa, so it was really nice to listen to.
Is this why your English is so good?
No, I moved around a lot as a kid, so I've just lived all around. But like, I very obviously don't have the South African accent, so.
No. It sounds more, I would say, East Coast US than anywhere else.
Really? I would say West Coast US. But yeah, doesn't matter.
Yeah, shows you how much I know about the US, doesn't it? I'm going to say US. Yeah. So the halving final point, I would say, is that a literal Bitcoin snaps in half, because some people still think a Bitcoin is a physical asset, like a gold coin or a silver coin. So I did that in a video to illustrate it's not an actual physical thing snapping in half like a biscuit. It's an ethereal, strange concept that, you know, we all get excited about, but when it comes down to it, it's actually a bit hard to visualize and conceptualize, particularly when around the world nowadays, the level of maths and physics and science education is just sliding down and down and down. So those that get it really well, and those that are less apt at science and maths and things, people like me, well, we struggle with it a little bit. So we have to reach out for these metaphors and illustrations of it to get there.
I actually have one.
But yeah, there's
I
three.
Have one more. I have a fourth one, and it's one that I heard a person say that it's basically the remaining supply of Bitcoin that is being halved. so there will be less Bitcoin, which is not true because there's always going to be the same amount of Bitcoin. But like, yeah, instead of thinking of it as like the rate at which the new supply is coming into the system is going to be at half that rate at this point, they were thinking of it as like the supply will be halved. So there's that as well. I feel like this person had a little bit more knowledge, like they were a little bit more aware, but they still got it a bit wrong. So that one was...
This sounds like the sort of thing a crypto influencer would say. Was this like BitBoy or like...
This was like a conversation I heard in public.
I feel okay.
Like this is like one of the big, I guess, perks to kind of being a woman in crypto is like people don't necessarily really think that I'm in the space a lot. So I was just hanging out with some friends and...
Hang on, that's awful.
It was friends
that's
of friends.
That's absolutely awful. That's misogyny in 2024.
Yeah, but it worked to my advantage.
One of the perks of being in crypto is that people don't think, No.
Like, seriously, I was just at the table and they were talking about Bitcoin. And I really love listening to people in a way that they don't engage me. Like, they think that, you know, they actually say what's on their mind because they think that I don't have any of the information. So I heard this and I was just like, I would just keep quiet.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so it's cool because I get to hear a lot of, like, unfiltered opinions because people think that I don't know anything about the space. So it worked to my advantage really nicely. So that's one I heard and I was just like, oh, like, oh my.
I mean, yeah, I guess you do kind of want to bite your tongue there, but yeah, that's also incorrect, but I see why it's closer to the actual definition. I guess what we need is to say that it's the Bitcoin issuance halving or something, or words to that effect.
I feel like...
Yeah, people just get distracted by it.
Yeah, it's all these people who are in math class and they're wondering what the hell they should be dividing by two. They're just like, I know how to divide by two, but I don't know what to divide.
No, exactly.
Oh my God. Okay, so that was like a bit...
I haven't had any really weird ones. I haven't had like any really weird off the wall ones.
Well, except for the physical one. So I think that was pretty weird. I would have never thought of that. And I would also never have assumed somebody would think that the price would be halving, because that's just like, why would somebody code that into this asset? You know, it makes absolutely no sense on any level, but I would never have thought of that. Like, that came as a shock.
Thinking of meme coins instead.
Yeah. We have meme coins for that.
Meme coins do halve regularly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another one that it isn't really a misconception about what the halving is. It's more a misconception about what the halving could do. And I had a journalist ask me, oh my God, the room smells like pancakes suddenly. I don't know what's going on. Sorry, really off topic. But I had a journalist. Well, I mean, it is in the morning for you. I wish I could transfer the smell. But yeah, it was a journalist that asked me about whether the Bitcoin halving would lead to a drop in miners, like whether many miners would just exit the space because it becomes difficult for them to survive, given that like their rewards will be halved. And I get irritated with this question a lot, and I think I gave them a little bit of a spicy Maggie answer on this one because I was just kind of like, think about it this way. Like, you're thinking that miners, you know, just... capitalize on the Bitcoin they get, right? You know, they just sell it immediately. So if they get like X amount of Bitcoins they're able to mine per day, they just sell that off for whatever, you know, the price is. But that's not true. There's actually highly sophisticated business models in mining. And a lot of the miners are playing the long game with Bitcoin. So I seriously doubt that miners sell absolutely all the Bitcoin they actually mine. I'm 100% sure they keep a lot of it because they wait for it to appreciate in value. And they're playing the long game here. And they also know that if they keep in business, you know, the Bitcoin that they're mining now might be less, but the scarcity that the halving creates is going to drive prices up in the long term. So I'm pretty sure that, like, that's a misconception that really bothers me. I don't know if you have a different opinion about it.
No, I totally agree. I mean, even on that note, you can point them towards the public holdings listings of miners around the world. And there's lots of, you know, big name miners that have the amount of Bitcoin they hold on their balance sheets, which is publicly available. Particularly the American miners. So Bitcoin Treasuries is a good place to go to, bitcointreasuries.net. And then if you just look at the financials disclosures of people like Marathon and Riot and other, you know, big US miners, well, they have to literally show how much Bitcoin they're holding. So he or she could look at that list and be like, oh, wait, it looks like some of these guys are actually managing this asset like the asset for which it is. You know, if you're a business and your business is to make money, like some of it you would obviously save because that's good business practice. And if you just think of Bitcoin as money, then okay, I made some money today. What am I going to do with it all? Okay, I'm going to pay some salaries, I'm going to pay some of my electricity costs, some of my infrastructure costs. Maybe I'll do some R&D, but ultimately, hopefully, I'm going to save some because that's how business works, right? So it's almost a bit naive of that person, that questioning to think.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing was
put into cash.
I feel like I should frame this by saying this was a mainstream media. It was a top tier mainstream media, but it was mainstream. So I do understand the question coming from like somebody who's not really like deep in the crypto space, but also like I think with Bitcoin, like yeah, you can save some, but like it's the next step to that is like automatically by saving Bitcoin, you're making that investment. Whereas if you're saving your dollars or your pounds or your euros, you're kind of doing the opposite. You're just kind of like, didn't put this money into anything, so now I'm just going to be able to buy less with it later. Which really sucks. It's just, I feel so cheated every time I think about that. Like, this was my whole life. You know something really cool about your video about the South African village that was, like, adopting Bitcoin? One of the women that you interviewed, she mentioned that people were asking her why she was spending so much time at home learning about Bitcoin, learning stuff. And she was like, I was learning about money. And I think that was like a really strong thing of her to say. So kudos. I don't remember her name, for which I apologize. But
she's great. Ellie. Yeah.
I thought that was...
That resonated with you.
Yeah, it was very powerful to say you're learning about money because we think we know about money because we're taught in school, but I think we actually don't. I don't think we're taught about exactly how much inflation affects the money that you save. We're not really taught how to invest. Like, I had an economics class in the U.S. when I was a teenager, and that was like... literally all I got. Like, I learned some basics about, you know, scarcity, supply, and demand, and that's all I got. I had a great teacher, so like that was very useful when I was entering the blockchain space, but still, Jesus. So yeah, that was a strong one. Anyway.
Yes, that's another thing that people overlook, and particularly mainstream journalists. They just think that the Bitcoin space is full of speculators. And in reality, there's a lot of people that put in a lot of deep work to understanding, like, well, firstly, to understand the problem with the existing solution. Like, Bitcoin is not just a thing that exists for the sake of it. It was a solution to the existing problem, which is, you know, rampant money printing, like insane central banking measures, and of course, like the financial crisis. It's no coincidence that in the first Bitcoin block, the Genesis block, it literally says, chancellor on the brink of second bailout. Like, come on. It's a direct commentary about the state of the world, the state of the financial world. So when people come at it still with these rather naive questions in 2024, you're a bit like, mate, like, do the work, please. But that's also a commentary about journalism as a whole, because a lot of journalists will be presented with, okay, you need to write a story tomorrow about biomedical devices in Novartis, and then the next day you need to write about how the housing market in Lithuania is on the rise. Like, they have to ask, you know, relatively basic questions to get to the actual crux
understand
of the story.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I started in the crypto space as a copywriter, so I do understand them because, like, one day I'd be writing about something incredibly complicated that I don't understand, which for me at the time was blockchain. As a copywriter in the space, it was actually very difficult to, like, I had to go and ask smart people incredibly idiotic questions. Like, I would have to ask the very basics, and they just look at me, and I could see that they were just why are you even here? So I do get journalists, like, they need to, they're working under time pressure, and they need to understand, so they have to ask, like, from the A's and B's. But it is a little bit like, I mean, you could have read a couple articles before that sometimes. But what you mentioned about the Genesis block of Bitcoin makes me think I have this like really like strong, I don't know, connection to like thinking about the future with like Bitcoin and kind of like this dystopian lore, because, you know, the way you said it was like almost like, you know, the legend of the first block and what it says, and like it almost sounds like something like a legend, something like a religion. And when I was thinking about the Bitcoin halving, I wanted to talk about what it means to us culturally, because I have this vision of how in like hundreds and hundreds of years, you know, people are using Bitcoin, it's their money and everything, they're almost kind of worshiping it, and the Bitcoin halving is like Christmas. You know, it's like this huge event and it means so much and people celebrate it and everything is orange and nobody really knows why. Like kind of like, you know, Christmas is all red and everything because of Coca-Cola. But what is your like vision of the cultural impact of the halving in the future? Like, are we gonna, how do we celebrate it? How do we experience it as a community, as a people?
The weird thing is that certain subsets of the Bitcoin community and the crypto community already celebrate the halving because they know what it represents. Like, even myself, I'm going to Warsaw next week. It's for a film festival. that part of it is a halving party, which I don't know what it's going to be like. I've not been to a halving party before because the last halving was during the pandemic, but it's quite an odd thing to celebrate, isn't it? I mean, the idea, you use the word worship there, Magdalena, and like that makes me a bit uncomfortable because I don't like the religious facet to Bitcoin. It is just money. But there are obviously, of course, like, you know, evangelists and evangelical people that will go out of their way to spread this message. To some extent, I am one of them, but I'm also trying to, in private, and I'm trying to challenge my own preconceived ideas and my own convictions to this thing, because I just don't understand how this thing is going to pan out, you know.
Yeah, I do get what you mean. Like, I think if Bitcoin becomes a religion, that's an issue, because I have an issue with religion in general. Like, I'm fine with all religions as they are, as a faith and everything, but I feel like there's a lot of undercurrents of control and prejudice that build up over time in religions and like this blind faith. So yeah, as long as like people keep questioning, I think we're fine.
This is it. And that's why although I hate this sort of atmosphere of like toxicity and challenging everything in the Bitcoin space, it's also one of the reasons why it will last longer. Because as long as you have these convicted few and the convicted few that are also challenging everything, then you hopefully won't create this atmosphere that religions do, which means we won't go to war over it. Because, you know, 99% of all wars ever were over religion. It's only sort of relatively recently that they're less
religion or money. It's religion or money. And I think like that's...
But religion was money for so long.
You know, oh, God, yes. That's exactly the problem.
You're giving your money to the church or to...
Yeah, that's exactly the problem. Like, the minute something becomes like a religious faith, like it starts getting really intertwined with power and stuff, and that's basically what leads to these issues. But yeah, that's so basically our consensus on this is, as long as you have people who are very convinced, but also people who are convinced but constantly questioning, that's like gonna save us from getting this like worship religious situation that's gonna lead to war.
Sure, but I mean, we already have statues of Satoshi, you know? There's one Hungary, I think, you know, the face of the statue.
Isn't it the first one in Hungary?
I think so, yeah, but I imagine there'll be more.
Yeah, it was brand new news, like it's pretty new.
So like if this is it in 2024, what's it going to be like in 2028 and so on and so forth? Because if Bitcoin does become this truly global, truly incredibly worthy and expensive movement, then... what is it going to look like in 50 years? And yeah, maybe it will be the new Christmas. It's kind of weird to think, but then my idea of the future always looks different to what the future actually is. Like, I had no idea that the pandemic would hit. I had no idea that, you know, we'd be able to conduct podcasts from all around the world, you know, these kind of things. And yet nowadays we take them for granted. So I think that the future of Bitcoin is going to still look even more different than how I predict it will be.
You know, when you said the statue of Satoshi and everything, it really makes me think of one of my favorite movies. It's Cloud Atlas, and they have like all sorts of different timelines. I don't know if you've seen this movie, but they have different timelines, and in one of them, it's like...
I started reading the book.
Oh, it's my favorite book. It's David Mitchell, right? Yeah, it's David Mitchell. It's my favorite book. I have a couple favorite books and favorite movies, but this is like my absolute all-time favorite book. And the book is very different from the movie, but I think it's the same thing of like in one of the timelines, which is set in the future, you have like I think she's like a clone, basically, Sonmi. And in one of the timelines that comes after that, more in the future, this same like clone, because due to the circumstances, like in Cloud Atlas, like she basically kind of inadvertently was involved in a revolution of sorts, basically. And in the future, they worship her as a goddess, even though like she wasn't, they worship something completely different than what she actually was, but it's really, really interesting. And that's what I was thinking when you were like, there's a statue of Satoshi. And I'm like, oh God, here we go. Like, nobody's going to know who it is. Nobody knows who Jesus is, right? But anyway, we're getting back into the religion, but that's what it makes me think of, like how people in the future are going to look back and be like, who was Satoshi?
They still do it now, right? There are documentaries and books and people trying to track him down. And
yeah, and was it Craig Wright, who recently got like disproved in court in the UK that like he's not Satoshi?
He's a fraud. And we can now say it publicly without being defamed and, you know, with a lawsuit thrown against us. So thank God for the UK law courts. Didn't think I'd say that on a Monday morning. But yeah, that whole debacle was terrifying and awful, and it's so good that they've finally been able to just say it publicly that, you know, this guy was never Satoshi. And
I know, right? Yeah,
but it does mean that, you know, it does mean that people are still, and they're going to forever try to find out who this person is, because the story is just so fascinating. Like, humans love mystery. Humans love these quests. and they're always going to try to find out who this person was. So,
that's what I love so much about the blockchain space and about crypto and everything, is like this lore we have. The way we tell our story, it's almost like we're leaning into this, like, we love mystery, we love fun, we love laughs, and there's this whole serious ecosystem that's there, but it's not inhibited by, you know, it has to be a certain way. So we're telling its story in a completely different way. And it's something that I really love about the crypto space, that we're able to keep that story, because that story is what essentially lures people in, and it what makes us think that something is significant. Like, we build it up to be that way. I think that's really important. It's something that I think we're doing right. It's just a matter of time until it reaches more people.
Yeah, I think it's also like dangerous as well. Like, the narratives that are spun in the crypto space in particular can harm new investors, new people coming in. And, you know, who in their crypto space hasn't been rug pulled or hasn't, you know, lost all their money on some sort of project or investment or whatever. So while there are good actors trying to do good things in this space, I'd say that the majority, particularly in crypto, they either think they're doing something good and it's not, or they are generally just out to get money. I mean, you know, like, I don't know if you've seen Zach XBT, but he's just been on the rampage recently. He's like an on-chain sleuther, a guy that basically spends his days trying to find out who is scamming who is stealing money from who, and then reporting about it publicly. And I've just been obsessed with his account for the past couple of weeks, because he's just been calling out people left, right, and center, and rightly labeling a lot of these frauds, scammers, thieves, for who they are. Because it's a space that has these attractive and alluring narratives, as you say, but at the same time, if there's nothing underpinning it, you know, there's no actual project and it is just vaporware, then we've got to be really careful to highlight that to people, to keep them safe and to ensure that they don't realize that there are, of course, true innovations in this space, like Bitcoin. But if they get put off by the next dog token or dog and or hat token or whatever it may be, then they're never going to see that, okay, the reason why they got into crypto in the first place is because of this. Perhaps it's nihilism, perhaps it's looking for someone to save the money, perhaps it's the memes, perhaps it's the story. But if that draws them in and then they don't get to the Bitcoin thing, then we've lost, you know? Like, yeah, but at least in my opinion, I think we've lost.
I do get that. I definitely think there's like equal parts danger and good and like spinning these narratives and like this whole like culture of this community. But I do think that it's also good. This was a couple episodes ago. I was talking to my guest Aragorn, and he was talking about how we really need to introduce in schools like more ontological subjects thinking. So like basically teaching people to distinguish fact from fiction, teaching people to do their own research, that kind of thing. You know, and I think that that's still missing, because we're still living in a world where we've kind of largely been told the way things are, and we still kind of subscribe to that. And people are starting to only just break out of that. And that's why I think it's so easy to exploit this space and like it's spirit, essentially. Speaking of spirit, I wanted to talk about your experience of the last halving. Like, I don't know, like, when exactly you came into the crypto space. I've experienced one halving when I was already in the space, and it was very early on. But I wanted to hear your story. Like, what was it like? What did it feel like right before it? What do you think people were talking about? What were you thinking? What happened immediately after? That kind of thing.
Sure. I mean, I was using Bitcoin in 2012. But I didn't understand it, and I thought it was rubbish. Like, I thought that, you know, what's the point of this thing? It's slow, it's clunky, it's hard to use, it's hard to get your hands on. So yeah, I didn't unfortunately keep any of that. But the halving in 2020 was when I was sort of back in the Bitcoin space a bit more meaningfully. And I remember just thinking, okay, people are getting very excited about this thing, but I don't really understand what's the point. You know, why can't we just keep the Bitcoin level where it is for longer? Because I want to stack more of it, please. And then when the actual halving came up, I was so distracted by everything that was going on with the pandemic. I lost my job like a month before as well, that for me, it didn't really feel like a giant celebration. It felt like a bit of a non-event. So this one is different in that I actually know it's coming. I'm prepared for it, going to a party for it as well. And, you know, it's a significant milestone event in the Bitcoin space. So this one is going to be my first proper one, let's say. The other two do not count at all. So I guess maybe I'd ask you the same question. You know, what was your experience? And was this a 2021 or a 2016 one?
It was a 2021 I was in. So I got into the crypto space in late 2019. So by the time April 2020 rolled around, I was really still very fresh. I was fresh out of uni, and it was a bit like, for me, like I'd just gotten into the space, and Anthony, who's a co-founder of Nexo, just like he wrote to me one morning, I think it was like in February or in March. He's like, I want you to create like some materials for our clients, like an article and some like, what is it? And a landing page for the Bitcoin halving. And I was like, the what now? Like, I was still so confused. Like, I was barely getting a grasp on crypto and blockchain and all of like the different ecosystems and the tokens and the coins. So yeah, it took me like quite a long time. Like, I did a lot of research. I read a lot of things. Like, I really read so many materials. I spent days just combing through everything and like kind of picking one of our blockchain devs' heads about it. And I developed a good understanding, I think, of it, and we wrote some good materials. But for me, it was just like, I was still so new that I wasn't really sure how much I subscribed to the space yet, if you know what I mean. Like, I think it takes a few months to be like, yeah, I totally believe this. Like, I'm all in. Like, it took me a long time to understand, and then even longer to be just like, to compare and contrast to what I was seeing in the like traditional financial like and tech spaces versus the blockchain space, and to appreciate blockchain for what it is. Because like you said, I think early days, like even as like close as 2019, it was still a bit clunky. It can still feel a bit clunky at times now. And I think that's okay. We'll grow into it. But yeah, I was very like unsure. So for me, it was like this, the halving was actually for me a huge learning opportunity. But then I also remember like the energy in the space was really weird because of COVID. Like, you know, there was all this like during the COVID, like I remember the day that like the pandemic was sort of like announced kind of in the Western world. And I just remember the price of Bitcoin going bunk, and I was like, it's okay. Like, we're dead. Like, space is dead. Because I was so young in it, and like I'd been in this space for 3 months, I had no idea. And I was just like, well, I mean, I'm gonna do my best to do my job as long as I have one. I actually was like, I kept my job. Like, thank you, Nexo. Yeah, and then like when the halving rode around, like it was so pandemic-y. There was so much uncertainty. And I just remember like on the day, like there was some like peaks in price right before the halving, but then they would like keep going away. So I felt like there was so much uncertainty and everybody was so distracted and so insecure. And then when the halving came, like nothing much happened. And I was just like, great. But then over time, we saw the effects, like the end of 2020, that last bull run, it started then. And I distinctly just remember kind of almost feeling the scarcity of the halving build up after the event, like after April. Like, I just felt like you could kind of tell, you know, that the scarcity was building up, that institutions were like kind of being like, what if we were to invest in Bitcoin? So that was my last experience. I felt like it was like prices were a little bit uncertain, but like generally trending up right before the halving. Nothing happened during the halving. And then like about 9 months after, almost like a gestation period, it's like Bitcoin was pregnant. and then it just kind of went boom. And in all honesty, I don't think it's all that different now. The main difference that I see was that if in the previous halving, before the halving, there wasn't really much in the ways of institutional adoption for Bitcoin. But now we already have the basic crux of it. And I think we all know that like the current prices in Bitcoin are probably due to a lot of institutional adoption kind of moving back in. And I've actually been asked, like, do you think this is priced in? Like, do you think the halving is priced in because of like the institutional adoptions? I really don't, because I think that the natural scarcity it creates over time, not immediately after the event, is going to like push it up even more. So yeah, I actually think they're quite similar. I think I'm very different though. If like at that time I was just trying to deal with pandemic and my life after university and learning about Bitcoin, this time I'm just watching. I'm just really more interested in observing. It's been a weird ride, I think, with the halvings. What I don't like about them is the hype. I hate the hype, because all I've been asked by journalists, and I don't know if you've like noticed this as well, like from like February, even January, everybody is asking about the halving. That's all they want to talk about, besides ETFs, obviously. And it kind of pisses me off, to be honest, because I'm just like, there's first of all, a lot more going on in the ecosystem. And second of all, you're creating this lead up. You're creating all this expectation. Nothing's going to happen so much on the actual day. I mean, unless something breaks, which I don't think it will. Like, I'm pretty certain it won't. I'm not a fan of the hype. I think that that actually creates a lot of tension in the space. And tension in more retail investors as well. Because they're just like, should I be buying now? What should I be doing? What's your take on the hype then?
Well, it's a marketing loop. Like, it's I know that it's annoying having to cover the same story over and over again and have to answer the same questions about this thing when they're all readily available now. But it also helps to attract the next wave of people interested in Bitcoin, because, you know, the more that Bitcoin continues to show that it's working, that it's a better system than the financial system we live in, and it's a way to opt out of that system, then the more people are going to, you know, use it as money, not necessarily as a speculative tool. That's the other thing. Like, yeah, you could make the argument that the halving attracts these tourists who come in, dump a load of money, get wrecked, and, or, you know, get burnt, and then move out of the space. That's obviously not good at all. But for every, you know, 10 people that join, thanks to the halving and thanks to this marketing sort of loop every 4 years, some of them do stay, some of them put in the money and the time to understand what Bitcoin is and to understand, you know, the real revolution that it represents. Some people also, you know, it's a bit like, you know, the meme coins, the crypto stuff, like that also draws people in, and you almost hope that they'll get onto Bitcoin from that entry point. But sadly, it's not always that evident, is it? I know a lot of people that go into crypto and stay in crypto and never actually learn what the point of Bitcoin is, like why we even have this system in the first place. So yeah, the marketing loop of every 4 years, I know it's frustrating, you know, I live through it as well. But I think the fact as well that it's part of a presidential election in the US, it's that the timing of it is always like quite interesting, right? And so yeah, that almost spicy. Adds to this multi-loop. Yeah, like if you look, I was just opening the news today to check what you're saying about, like, you know, this marketing stuff, and Fortune wrote an article this morning about the halving, the Times wrote an article about the halving, and these aren't not negative hit piece articles. These are educational, informative.
Oh, that's
articles.
Really good, because in the last halving, we didn't have those. Nobody but the crypto media was writing about the halving last time. It just goes to show it's very mainstream now.
Yeah, more and more mainstream, and at least more and more mainstream with a slightly positive take, which is nice as well. I'm really sorry there are people now eating their breakfast around me, even though I was in a private room. Sorry. But yeah, that's another thing that, you know, the fact that there are positive takes on this thing is a lot more encouraging, at least for the longevity of the space. But yeah, there's still going to be hit pieces. Like, there's another one that says from CNBC, Bitcoin is just FOMO.
Oh, of course.
Great. You know. Fiat is like the worst FOMO ever, so I don't know.
Well said.
Don't I put my Bitcoin hat on too much this morning?
Oh my God. I think I do get what you mean. Like, I think what I'm bothered by is the hype that comes with price, like price speculation, because it's all about the price. And that bothers me because I just think that this is more than just about the price. You know, it's about our whole economic structure and the financial system we want to live in. It's not so much about get rich quick. I'm going to buy some Bitcoin before the halving and then like ride that train forever. I think that's what bothers me about the hype, but I do understand what you're saying about the marketing cycle. And I would agree with that it is healthy to get all those people in, because you just kind of get them in now. And then over time, like you said, they just kind of grow and they become a part of this space and this world, which I think is really cool. But yeah, we talked about price a little bit.
The other thing is they also don't have to become part of the space. Like, I want to live in a world where there aren't Bitcoiners anymore. There are just people using it as money. You know, a bit like in the Whitsun's video that you watched, you know, those people are still calling themselves Bitcoiners, but they're using Bitcoin more than they're using their own local currency. And at some point, they'll just be regular people, just using the better money. Like, you know, at some point, people went from being like, oh, I'm pro-knife, we should all use knives to cut things and, you know, use it as a tool. And then suddenly it's just like, yes, we all use knife because it's the best tool for the job. And I think that, well, I hope that at some point it'll just be like, okay, there was this fiat money experiment. It was a crap tool. It served a purpose. It helped people to fight wars. And, it, you know, that was what there was needed at the time. But now we're in, you know, the next millennium. We have Bitcoin, which is much better money that has a lot of better principles around it, a lot better tech around it. And that's the tool that we should be using for the job, for the, you know, for the next future. And hopefully we'll get to that point. But because a lot of people almost get put off by these crazy Bitcoiners and these crazy hardcore maxis. And yeah, and it's, so while there is culture and that's important, I don't think that everyone and their dog should necessarily start stacking Bitcoin and then join Telegram groups and this, that, and the other. Sorry, people chatting around me as well.
Yeah, it just sounded really like there was a child. you know what I think of it as, like, choosing the best currency to operate in? Like, it might be that, say, now you live in Europe and, you know, it's your best option is to, I don't know, hold euros, but you're just like, well, there's another currency abroad. Like, it's almost like forex trading, I guess, like, you know, just holding a different currency because it'll be give you, you know, better value over time, because there's like high inflation, say if you're in Serbia, for example, and like you don't really know what's going to happen to your money over time. But we did touch on price.
I think the transaction fees in that first block, a lot of people are going to want to be in that first block, the halving block. So I think that transaction fees during that point could really, really spike, and that could be interesting to watch. But it doesn't necessarily affect the price so much. It's more just people want that meme and that milestone thing of being like, I want to mine that block and I want to be in that block. So that could be interesting to see that pan out.
Yeah, I read...
The long-termist savings culture. Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, that's the way I think about, like, we should be talking about the Bitcoin halving in terms of price, the long-term store of value narrative, not the, is the price going to rise? But yeah, the other thing that I was, like, you just mentioned it with transaction fees, I was reading, I think it was an article that was talking about how miners are going to crank up transaction fees to make up for their halved rewards. Do you think, like, a lot of miners would do that? Like, does that, like, pan out for you, or... It's not really a thing.
What was the question? What will, like, miners do with the...
With transaction fees, essentially, whether they'll crank up transaction fees to compensate for halved rewards.
Well, users dictate transaction fees, right? And it's based on, you know, how much congestion there is and how much demand there is for block space. So miners can't do much on that. They can... You can go straight to miners for certain transactions. I mean, I know that Marathon was really keen to push that this year, but like, if I want to get my transaction in the block and, you know, the sats per VBite, or basically the cost of getting your transaction in the block is, say, at 6 sats per VBite, and I put 7 sats per VBite because that's just above the lowest one, then it's very likely my transaction will get put in the next few blocks. But, you know, if we all try to get loads of transactions into the block at one time, then that's going to raise the price and so forth. So miners don't have a say on this. They can try to, I don't know, they could try to mine faster for a period of time if they wanted to, but that would always get corrected by the difficulty adjustment every 2 weeks anyway. So there's not a huge amount that miners can do. And that's why a lot of people say that, oh, well, Bitcoin mining security is going to unravel if transaction fees don't go up over time. But you've seen the past 2 years of Bitcoin activity, and it's been very, very, very profitable if you're a Bitcoin miner because of all the layer two stuff that's going on Bitcoin that aren't necessarily actual transactions.
So it's kind of like in that column of misconceptions and fake news, I guess. Like yet another news story that like had it. The thing about miners cranking up transaction fees, because like you said, like users are actually the ones that like determine where those will be at. So I think like that's another fake news one.
It's just
a lot of misconceptions
about supply and demand, right? Like there's only so much you can put in a block, 7 transactions per second. I don't know how many in total go in a block. It's been a while since I've revised like Bitcoin statistics, and I'm really sorry to your listeners and viewers that I haven't quite got there. Because of that scarcity, if you want to be included in the next block, say you want to make a transaction right now in the Bitcoin on blockchain, then you're going to have to pay that fee. But there are other routes you can go down. If I wanted to pay you, say, 3 Bitcoin, then obviously I'd want it to be on-chain. But if I was going to pay you $3 or, you know, 4,000 sats, then I would do that on Lightning or another Layer 2 protocol that's on Bitcoin. So it's like you've just got to be ready for this, and you've got to have a certain level of education about the Bitcoin space in order to make more informed decisions, which is the same as in life, right? Like it's never going to be a walk in the park. And I think that part of the reason why it's important to study Bitcoin is because you are rewarded for studying it because you use it better. Just like the knife analogy, you know, the first time you use a knife, you don't know what you're doing. But, you know, by the 10th time you go to cut some bread or whatever, or butter your toast, you know what you're doing pretty comfortably. It just takes a few, you know, hours with Bitcoin, using it, understanding it, learning it, and you're already much better than the average mainstream media news reporter. Give it 10 hours, you're probably better than, you know, some crypto media reporters. 100 hours, you're already into the hobbyist territory, and 1,000 hours, you're doing pretty well. You know, you're going to use the Bitcoin protocol much, much better than most people on the planet. So I think it's really important to approach that and try to use this tool as best you can. So that you don't think that, you know, miners are pushing up transaction fees, because Well, yeah. I think they'd love to, of course, but they can't.
I have an actual thing to add to that, and I think it's very important to, like, ask people, talk to people in the space, and this is for our listeners. I think you've, like, seen me do it a lot of times as well. Like, there's a reason I have these conversations with people in the crypto space. Like, even if you feel like an absolute idiot after, ask people questions, ask people who might know, because, you know, even if they don't have the exact information, they might give you a good, like, just like Joe did right now, they might give you a very good idea of, like, this isn't quite right. Like, I think what you were reading was wrong or something. And I think it's very important to just talk to people that might know, even if you're not sure, because, like, really, humans are an incredible store of information, incredible resource that in the blockchain space is actually quite accessible. Obviously, be careful who you trust. But yeah, I would say if you're working in the blockchain space, ask your colleagues. Like, it's the best way to really find out. Ask someone who knows, who's been down that road before. So Joe, we're kind of running up a little bit late with our recording. And I always ask my guests right at the end whether there's a message or something they want our listeners to be left with from our conversation.
It's a lovely sentiment to close on. I would say invest in yourself. You know, ignore the crypto, blockchain, Bitcoin stuff. If your head isn't right and if your health isn't right, then you're going to make bad decisions anyway. Sorry about the kids around me. You know, Bitcoin's going to be here in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 100 years time. So as long as you've got your head right and you're in good health, then take Bitcoin a bit more seriously. And then I'd suggest people start asking questions about why Bitcoin's a thing. So look at, oh, why is inflation so high? And why is my money worth, you know, less and less every year? And why can't I buy a house? And why are salaries stagnating? And that will help you to understand why Bitcoin is the secondary or primary solution to a lot of those problems. And from then, study my content. Okay, but you know, I try to make Bitcoin explainable, understandable, and shareable with real life situations. So please do check out my content if you do want to learn more about Bitcoin. I hope you don't mind me shilling that.
Not at all. I think like that's that, but, yeah. That's why I kind of open the space to guests at the end. So if they have something, they can always shill. Alrighty, guys. So I think that's our episode for today on the Bitcoin halving. Check in with us again really soon. We'll have some episodes post halving as well, just to kind of see what happened. Yeah, basically have a play by play. And we'll see you next time on the Social Block. Alrighty, we're done.